used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. Today is Friday, December the 16th, 2016, and this is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I am your host today, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by our guest co-hosts, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
And Shauna Smith.
Hi there.
Welcome to the show, and welcome back, especially to you, Shauna. It's been a while. This is going to be my last show for the year, and I'm excited about what we have planned for you today. For our first interview, we'll be welcoming back vegan cookbook superstar Isa Chandra Moskowitz, author of many of my favorite cookbooks. She's also a restaurateur now, having opened her first vegan restaurant, Modern Love, in Omaha, and the second location very recently in Brooklyn, New York. And now she has just published her biggest book ever, the Super Fun Times Vegan Holiday Cookbook. She'll be on the show to tell us about her book and how fun it is to cook vegan and entertain for the holidays. For our feature interview, we'll have Fern Levitt on the show. She is a seasoned documentary filmmaker with over 20 years of experience creating films mostly on human rights issues. However, she's just directed a film that uncovers and exposes the cold truths behind the dog sledding industry. Her film is called Sled Dogs and just won two awards at its debut at the Whistler Film Festival 2 weeks ago. We've had a chance to see it here at Animal Voices, and I can say it's a very compelling and thorough look into the sled dog industry, shedding light on the cruelties towards these dogs about which most of the public is not aware and certainly would not support. She'll be telling us about her findings in making this film, and that interview is coming up in about 27 minutes, so please do stay tuned. So getting back to Isa Chandra, I've been reading through her beautiful book, The Super Fun Times Vegan Holiday Cookbook, for the past several weeks. I had shown it to both of you here today. And just, yeah, beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's over 400 pages. It's her biggest book ever. And I've talked about this before on the show, is I just love reading through beautiful cookbooks. I love Isa's books. I have all of them except for one. So I was so excited to get this one because it's such a wonderful and satisfying task just to read through all the pages. And this book covers all different kinds of holidays throughout the year that you might celebrate. So not just the winter holidays. I'm looking here at Passover, Cinco de Mayo, and Mother's and Father's Days. There's Valentine's Day, 4th of July. So everything is covered here. But what I like about the recipes is that you can make them anytime, and they're just really great recipes for entertaining. And I know you, Sinead, you're familiar with Isa's food.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I've got a few of her books, and they're go-tos. There's some recipes I make all the time that are just from her books from years ago.
Do you make the seitan a lot?
Not a lot, but yeah. I have before out of her one of her past few books, Appetite for Reduction, and I made this stew, the portobello steak stew, out of that book. And my boyfriend, who is an omnivore, has been talking about that stew ever since I made it. So I think I need to make more of the seitan stuff.
So my plan for last night was to bake you two goodies so we could review them on the show like I've done before, but that didn't happen. I had problems. I had major computer issues. But I do want to make the peanut butter brownies. I'm going to make them tonight, I think. I'm going to make the cranberry spice oatmeal cookies, like just for Christmas gifts, because it's kind of that time of the year. But there's this stuffed seitan roast definitely that I want to make. It's cheesy and has leeks or spinach or something in it. Can't wait to make those. So we will be talking to Isa more about her book later, but now on to you, Shauna, because you just got back from a trip. Tell us about that.
I did. I actually took two trips recently since I've been on, I haven't been on the show since. I did a trip in Costa Rica for 2 weeks, and then I had a work trip in Mexico. You know, I thought when I was going to go to Costa Rica that I would see a lot of more animals than I did, but I didn't. I actually went on a 6-hour hike and only saw one snake. And I was actually really freaked out because I was like, I don't know if this is going to hurt me or not, so I'm just going to back up. I saw some monkeys, though, lots of birds. Birds were really great in Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
In Mexico, though, I was in Puerto Vallarta, and the pelicans there were just, they were so beautiful. I happened to stay at the Hilton in Puerto Vallarta, and they had this rooftop pool, and the pelicans would come down so low, and you could, like, really hear their wings, like, flapping while they went by you. It was really beautiful.
Pelicans are pretty big, aren't they?
Yeah, they were huge. Yeah, and there was, like, a bunch of them. Like, 4 or 5 of them would, like, go right down low at the rooftop balcony, like, every day, and I was there for, like, several hours every day, so...
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. Just the only thing that I was, I mean, I guess I shouldn't really be surprised at this point, but I was there for work and I did a city tour, and we were going through the city and we were passing by this really old building, and the tour guide was like, oh, this used to be a bullfighting ring, but the parents passed away and the kids didn't want to keep it. So the bulls got shipped to Burger King. And I was the only one that didn't laugh. And I was like, this is so messed up. And he said it several times during our tour that day. And I was like, this is so awkward for me. Like,
yeah. Like, it's this joke that people regularly laugh at. Like, ah, ha, 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 the animals died.
Yeah, it was pretty weird. And I guess it's been a while since I've been around people that don't really know that I'm vegan. So it was kind of strange to kind of just sit there.
I would have yelled out, that's not funny. Hello, it's not funny.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely wanted to, but as I was on a work trip and I didn't really know anyone there.
Next time, speak your mind. It's not normal to perpetuate this type of violence in language. It's just disgusting.
Yeah, it's very awkward.
Yeah, and it's interesting how we're sort of, you know, we're expected to accept it and like, oh, calm down, it's not a big deal. But it is important to speak out about it when the time is right, because the fact is these animals feel, and matters.
Exactly. I mean, I definitely mentioned it throughout the rest of my trip. I mean, I talked a lot about, like, when people were like, oh, what about humane farms? And I was like, those don't exist, okay? Let's be honest right now, they don't.
Yeah.
And the restaurant, the Hilton, was actually super great, and it's just some good advice that I can give out to any vegans traveling is just ask, because when I was there, they knew that I was vegan, and the chef came out and asked me exactly what I could and couldn't eat. And we were having a group meal, and it was a 5-course, beautiful, traditional Mexican food. And he made all of the food for me vegan. And when I asked his advice, because I'm a travel agent, so I had my first vegan clients a few weeks ago, on what I should do for them, he said any 4-star hotel should be able to do anything that you want for them. And so I put that theory to the test the following morning. I ordered room service and I called and asked if they can make the waffles vegan. And they said yes, it would take a little bit longer, but absolutely. And they made it for me and it was amazing.
Wow.
I'm shocked and pleasantly surprised because, waffles and things like pancakes can easily be made vegan, but no one ever does it.
No, they won't.
I would never expect to get vegan waffles anywhere.
Yeah.
Other than maybe Issa's restaurant. We'll be having her on the show.
No, exactly. I never even thought to ask, really. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, when he gave me that advice, because he'd worked in several... I mean, the Hilton was a 4-diamond, so if they said no to me, I'd be a little bit shocked. But,
wow.
But, I mean, it was great. It was a great experience.
Well, thank you for sharing that, and more on food to come in a minute.
Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food, sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food, hey, even cooking food. Food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
So So our first interview today is with best-selling vegan cookbook author and restaurateur Isa Shandro Moskowitz. In addition to recently opening her second restaurant, Modern Love, in Brooklyn, she has also just published the Super Fun Times Vegan Holiday Cookbook, a tome of over 400 pages packed with gorgeous recipes and photos, proving that festive vegan food for any occasion is easy, delicious, and super fun to make. Isa is here today to give us some tips for entertaining this holiday season and to tell us about the book. Hello, Isa, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I have enjoyed your food and your cookbooks ever since you wrote Vegan with a Vengeance in 2005, and you seem to have an endless output of creativity, taste, and fun in all the recipes you create. But for those of our listeners who aren't familiar, can you start by describing your journey with veganism and vegan cooking? When and how did that start, and how would you describe your approach and style with regards to the food you make?
It's pretty simple. I just started... I went vegan in 1989, and there wasn't much vegan food around, so I just started cooking, and that was when I learned how to cook. So I just it wasn't like I made a transition from cooking meat to cooking vegan. So I just cooked all the food that I wanted to, and just made it vegan. And that's basically what followed with my approach, is just comfort foods, foods that I love, and some fancy foods that I want to eat, and so I make them vegan.
No kidding. And you just have such a huge repertoire of all these recipes that you've created. It's totally astounding to me. So you've written the book, The Super Fun Times Vegan Holiday Cookbook. It's your biggest book yet. The subtitle is Entertaining for Absolutely Every Occasion. And you are an entertainer from the narrative in all your past books that I have read, and this one too. I've known you to be one who loves to cook for people. And we were talking about just vegan waffles. I know you make those for sure. I have your vegan brunch book. And so what are some tips that you can give for being a great host when entertaining guests during the holidays?
I think just, first of all, just being relaxed and not stressing out too much, and being prepared always helps. I think having plenty of food for everyone, having music on, just having the right atmosphere, I think then you really can't go wrong. So as far as like specific tips, I think it's good if you're really new at hosting or really new at cooking to do a couple of run-throughs of the recipes that you're going to do, so you're not like stressing out the day of. And to just read the whole recipe through, make sure that you have everything you need, make sure you know what you're going to be serving everything in. You know, don't like make a salad and be like, oh, I have no bowls for this. So just doing a little bit of planning for a bigger occasion.
Yeah, I can say entertaining stresses me out a little bit, and I'm known to be cooking for days and days and days beforehand because I just want everything to be perfect. Haven't done a lot of entertaining lately for that reason. So Sinead here has a question for you.
Yeah. Hi, Issa. Around the holidays especially, there are, you know, there are lots of parties, and whether you're hosting something yourself or being invited to a potluck or something, then I find myself wondering about appetizers a lot. What kind of appetizers I'd want to serve to guests, particularly omnivores, at holiday dinners or parties or anything like that. So what kind of appetizers have you got in the book?
There's appetizers. The book is arranged by holiday, but there's appetizers in every section. So there's probably, I don't know, 50 to 75 appetizers in there. And they all range, and you can mix and match even though the chapters are arranged by holidays. For instance, The Oscars party has the most appetizers of any, and you can just use those, for any occasion. So there's everything from, like, phyllo asparagus cigars, which seem a little bit fancy, but they're not really. Instead of pigs in a blanket, there's carrots in a blanket. And then there's things like dips and fritters, stuffed mushrooms, spring rolls, all sorts of things that are just like finger foods, really easy to pick up and shove into your mouth.
I like the shoving into your mouth part. I totally want to make, I want to make your devilish potatoes. I bought 3 bags of little potatoes last week. I was going to triple the recipe and it didn't happen yet. It's going to, but they are so cute. And when I was going to make them for a party for omnivores, because whenever one of my workplaces, whenever we get together, I always try to bring something to impress them, but something that they're familiar with as well. So I've done a cheese platter in the past, for example. And I remember I was reviewing your Vegan Pie in the Sky book, and I made I think there was like a raspberry chocolate pie tort that I made, and people love that. And mm-hmm. I remember someone asking me, how do you do that without dairy? Like, so questions are good. So I was going to make those little, can you describe what the devilish potatoes are?
Sure. Yeah. And I should say, I didn't come up with that. I saw it on the internet, just little Yukon Gold potatoes that are shaped like eggs. The recipe I came up with, but the idea I didn't. And then they're piped with potatoes inside, so they're like really similar to deviled eggs. Use some turmeric in the filling so that it's nice and yellow, and it just appeals to people of all walks of life. First of all, it's gluten-free. You can make it nut-free. It's a potato, so it's not like it's something unfamiliar to people that they're going to freak out about. So I just think it's like a really good all-purpose crowd pleaser.
Yeah, and they'll run to them thinking that they're deviled eggs, which we're all familiar with. It's just quaint for me, because I used to make those deviled eggs when I was a lot younger and not vegan yet. And I'm thinking, looking at like preparing for making these, like I read the recipe like about 10 times already, like going through every step and thinking like, this is going to be really easy and doable to make, and people are going to love these. So the winter holidays are all about comfort, and I guess all holidays are. People really love to eat really well. I know you do too. I definitely do. I'm sure Shauna and Sinead definitely do here. And they want a centerpiece at their dinner table that's usually from a dead animal. We don't do that here at Animal Voices, and neither do you. So you have a lot of hearty main courses for the various holidays throughout your book. But what I want to talk about is seitan, because I consider you to be the queen of seitan. I actually first learned how to not become scared of seitan when I had the opportunity to cook with you when you were in Vancouver here many years ago, actually, and I was helping you out. Okay. And we were making seitan kebabs.
I remember making so much seitan.
Yeah, and then I remember thinking, wow, this is, I remember you saying it was easy, and then me agreeing, like, I can do this. I've made seitan since then. I can't imagine why anyone would buy the seitan in the stores when you can make like a huge pound or two for like nothing. So a lot of people, I'm sure, don't even know what seitan is. Can you tell us about seitan? What is it, and why should we praise it?
Sure. Well, it's what we call wheat meat. It's gluten, basically, from wheat flour that forms a meat, and it was popularized by monks in the 60s, so you know it has to be good. It's just really versatile, really meaty. Non-vegans love it. It's just a really great, if you want something hearty and like a good solid protein for the center of the plate. I mean, if people in the restaurant ask me what to compare it to, I would compare it to steak, whereas, you know, depending on how the texture, on how you're doing the seitan. But we, like, in the restaurant, serve surf and turf, and seitan is our turf. So, yeah, it's just really great for pot pies, for tacos, I mean, really for any place that you want a really great protein.
Yeah.
And it absorbs really good, absorbs flavors, absorbs marinades. And if you're making it yourself, you can make the flavors and textures to your liking also, which is fun.
And you've put a bit of a twist on at least a couple of the seitan recipes I looked at. The spinach and pine nut cheesy roast. I totally have to make that one. That looks amazing. It's stuffed with like a spinach and sort of cheesy, I think it's nutritional yeast, is that right? To make it cheesy?
It's like a cashew cheddar.
Oh, cashew cheese. Okay.
Yeah, and pine nuts. And actually, when I think about that, I don't know where I saw that or how I came up with that. I just had this vision of like a roast in the center of a table, like oozing with cheese and spinach.
And you made it.
So, yeah, there's a couple of seitan centerpieces in there. Yeah, there's, I think there's like 3 or 4 seitan roasts, and they're all not just, they're not like variations of each other. They're each unique. But all of them will work as a centerpiece for any of the major holidays, really.
So let's talk about desserts. You have some really decadent desserts in the book that I'm dying to try out. Number one, the jelly donuts. I don't think I've ever made donuts before. I've seen my mom make them a lot, and I'm so gung-ho to try those out. Because, again, I read the recipe like five times thinking, yeah, I can do this. I can do this. And there's the chocolate raspberry bouche de Noël, which, I read about five times thinking, yeah, I can do this. I'm like picturing my head. I've always been scared to roll the sheet cake because I'm afraid it'll fall apart, but you have really good instructions in there on how to successfully do that. But anyways, can you tell us about some of these just totally mouthwatering desserts in the book, maybe some of your favorites and the techniques that you use to make them without dairy?
Well, the donuts were for Hanukkah because the Hanukkah section is basically frying absolutely everything. And that one, you know, any yeasted dough doesn't need eggs. The binding comes with the gluten, and it's just, and I don't know, when people, it's one of the easiest doughs to make vegan. So that one was easy, just no eggs. and then some other things, like for the bouche de Noël, I did mess up that recipe a lot, which is why I'm so careful with the directions in there, because it is easy to crack.
That's much appreciated.
A cake when you're rolling it. The nice thing about that cake, though, is that you can cover it up with ganache if it does crack a little bit. But for things like buttercream, I don't use palm oil in the book either, which I have in past books, and I stopped just because the orangutan issues. So I use coconut oil and to make buttercream. And actually the whole book is like filled with lots of coconut oil, which refined coconut oil, which isn't a chemical process, is a really nice neutral taste. So I use that in place of butter in a lot of the recipes. Other replacements for eggs, really easy ones, like applesauce, flax eggs, which is flax seeds ground up and mixed with a liquid. Sometimes just leaving the eggs out, like I was saying, in a yeasted dough. So it's pretty easy. And then as far as milks go, I like to use unsweetened almond milk, but your favorite non-dairy milk should get the job done in most recipes.
You know, I always say there's no reason why desserts need to have dairy or eggs in them. And I told my brother-in-law that, who's a baker, and got him the, what was it, the Idiot's Guide to Vegan Bacon. So, yeah, there's just no reason. And you've definitely proven that in your book. So finally, what are you going to be making for Hanukkah and Christmas this year?
Well, I will be at the restaurant. So I... my family's coming in. I'm in New York right now at Modern Love Brooklyn. So my family's going to be here. And I don't know. We'll probably just go down to the restaurant and make some food. Probably make some latkes for Hanukkah. For Jewish Christmas, I say so in the book, it's Chinese food. So if you wanted to celebrate Jewish Christmas, you can just turn to the Chinese New Year section and make everything in that, which I think is what we're going to do, is make some Chinese food and go see a movie.
Sounds very Christmassy or Hanukkah-y. Sounds good. And I can't wait to try out your new restaurant. I don't get to Omaha, although my sister lives in South Dakota, and she's willing to make the 2-hour drive to go there just to see you. She's been totally planning it. But we will be in Brooklyn next year, so definitely going to be stopping off there as one of our mandatory food stops. Thank you, Issa, for coming on the show today to speak with us about compassionate cooking for the holidays and the Super Fun Times Vegan Holiday Cookbook. Entertaining for absolutely every occasion. I highly recommend getting the book, and you can also find Issa on her website, issachandra.com. Thanks very much, Issa. Happy holidays.
Thanks, you too.
All right. Well, we've got some news here today. We've got Canadian Tire. As it turns out, the Canadian Tire Corporation has decided to drop fur from their subsidiaries, SportCheck and Atmosphere, across Canada. So the news broke earlier this week through social media, and local advocacy group the Fur Bearers have officially verified that two of the corporation's large subsidiaries are moving away from the selling of fur through three sources. So SportCheck has said that they are managing their remaining inventory, but at this time they do not have any more, have any plans to add any more animal fur trimmed products to their inventory. And Atmosphere has said similarly, they're not fur free yet, but they haven't purchased any product containing fur this year. They said, "We are always evaluating product choices depending on what customers are asking for. If people are asking for warm coats but fur-free coats, then that's what we'll go for." So I think it's important to note that this is not being called an ethical decision by Canadian Tire. It's one that reflects a consistent message from their consumer base to, as the Fur Bearers put it, make fur history. So right on to
all the
people out there speaking out against fur trim, which is entirely unnecessary, especially in Vancouver.
Imagine that. Who knew that polls and protests would actually work?
Yeah. Yeah. So keep it up. Keep up the pressure, because if they don't feel that pressure, then they'll bring fur products right back in. We've seen that in other stores before. So right on. Send them a message. Canadian Tire, thank you for removing fur from a couple
so
of
shops. So progressive.
Shops.
I don't know if you said that already. I was on the phone.
Yeah, no.
it's just an amazing news story that came out this week. I couldn't even believe it. I posted it on our Facebook page too, Animal Voices Vancouver, if people want to read more about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so another bit of news this week. The BC government is calling for more study before it will consider funding a plan to put deer on birth control in the Victoria suburb of Oak Bay as a population control measurement. So while communities elsewhere in the province have received provincial funding for deer culls, Oak Bay appears to be the only community in BC at this point that are looking at non-lethal strategies for deer management. The current plan is to partner with a local stewardship group to trap and inject female deer with a contraceptive drug. But provincial staff are saying there's only one such drug that has ever been used in BC, and it's not currently in production. So a safe alternative needs to be identified. And they also need to get into specifics on the methods of how to capture the deer and administer the drug. If Oak Bay doesn't get funding from the province, then their fertility control project won't proceed. Mayor Niels Jensen said the plan should get conditional approval as a pilot project. And should Oak Bay go forward with a successful fertility control program, it can become a model for the rest of the province. So let's cross our fingers for Oak Bay, because that sounds like a great initiative.
Yeah, this has been a situation that activists have been getting into in the local area for a couple of years now. So I just looked up on our website, animalvoices.org. We did an interview almost 2 years ago now, January 9th, 2015, with Kelly Carson from Deer Safe Victoria. It's an animal advocacy group for the deer. And she's speaking about the deer cull in Oak Bay. If people want some background information on that to see what was happening at that time, definitely check that out. I remember the birth control was going to be an option. So
yeah, that's awesome. For other news, a vegan chain that I'm sure pretty much every vegan has ever heard of,
except for me,
is now expanding nationwide, and it should actually scare McDonald's. Steve Healy, the CEO of the healthy fast food chain Veggie Grill, is betting that its burgers taste as good or even better than McDonald's
Big
Macs.
Definitely better.
I mean, have you had a Big Mac? That tastes awful.
I don't even remember. The last time I had a Big Mac, I vomited, and that was the end of Big Mac.
Just by the title, I'm sure that you know that the grill is 100% vegan. Their burgers are made of pea protein, and their chicken sandwich contains soy, pea, and wheat protein. They started in 2006 serving fast casual food that has fewer calories and has cruelty-free items, rather than the traditional fast food. Its menu includes dishes like tempura green beans and fish tacos, with prices ranging from $3.50 to $11.50. The chain currently has 28 locations, all of which are in California, Washington, and Oregon. But recently, they have had a $22 million bump from investors. So now they're preparing to expand nationwide. And by 2020, they plan to be double in size. And so that's great. I personally know that there's a lack for fast food in Vancouver.
Yeah, I've actually emailed them years ago asking if I could start a veggie grill here, and they're not ready to go into Canada yet. They told me it looks like they're still not. I'm still going to be patiently waiting. That's my next business endeavor.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
So our feature interview today is with filmmaker Fern Levitt, whose documentary Sled Dogs premiered at the Whistler Film Festival earlier this month. The film takes an unprecedented critical look at the commercial dog sledding industry and has already picked up two awards following its premiere, including Best Female Directed Documentary and a tie for Best World Documentary. Fern is a 20-year veteran in filmmaking, mostly focusing on human rights issues in her documentaries. But today she joins us to shed some light about the sled dog industry, the film, and some of the controversy surrounding its premiere. Hello, Fern, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, very much our pleasure. So your film, Sled Dogs, is, as we've said, the first of its kind to explore the ethics of commercial dog sledding. Dog sledding is something that many people, especially in big cities, don't know very much about. So can you give us a bit of an introduction to the industry and what inspired you to make a film about it?
Well, they've been offering, I don't know for how many decades now, dog sledding tours for tourists. They're outside of Toronto, they're, you know, in Whistler, different parts of British Columbia. They're offering dog sled tours throughout Canada and the United States and even in Europe, where tourists can go and ride on a team of dogs pulling sleds. And this has been going on for a very long time. In fact, that's what led me and my husband to go dog sledding in 2010. It was, you know, it was something that I've heard about and something that I thought would be an awful lot of fun. And it was in the outdoors and around dogs, and I'm an animal lover. And so I, like many other tourists, went dog sledding. And so it's advertised as a great adventure. In the wilderness, being pulled by a team of huskies. So that's how I went, and that's what that is, you know, traditionally being offered to tourists.
Mm-hmm. So you explore two commercial dog sled operations in the film, one in Moonstone, Ontario, and the other in Snowmass, Colorado. What led you to cover these particular operations, and what did you find there?
Well, actually, I explored three. One we couldn't name, because which I'll get into in a second. But just to give you a little bit of background, because I think it's really important to understand that when we went dog sledding in 2010, and we went with friends of ours and went for a weekend of fun, we afterwards, when we had finished the 2 days of dog sledding, I asked where the dogs live, because you don't see where the dogs live. Usually when you come, you see the dogs are there and the sleds are there waiting for you, but you don't see where the dogs are, where they live, where they're living. So I asked the owner if I could see where the dogs lived, and just for my own curiosity and seeing, you know, maybe playing with some of the puppies. So he said they lived down the road, and I went down the road with him. And that's when I really came into one of the shocks of my life, because before me was a open field of 200, 300, or maybe more dogs, all on chains with plastic barrels as their only shelter. And you know, it was getting to be spring, and it was muddy, and the dogs were dirty, and I was quite upset with, I was very upset with what I saw, a bunch of dogs running around in circles on the end of their chains. And I was so upset with what I saw that I spontaneously asked the owner if I could take a dog home with me. And he said, yes, as a matter of fact, that they had 30 dogs that that were going to be retired, and if they didn't find homes for them, that they were going to put them down. And so, again, I had no idea that this was even legal. I had no idea that it's legal to keep dogs always on chains and legal in Canada to put a dog down. So we ended up taking home a dog. His name was Slater. And it was Slater that I found the impact of keeping a dog on a chain. He was the most wonderful dog in the whole world, but he was afraid of his own shadow. And you really saw the impact of this dog living on a chain for 9 years. And sorry, I know I digress, but to get back to your question, so when we decided that we were going to do this film, I went back to Choctaw. That's the place where I rescued my dog and saw the conditions of sled dogs for the first time, and asked if we could film there, telling him that I wanted, as a filmmaker, to explore this, whether this was a humane industry or not, because at that time, it was already after the killing of the 100 sled dogs in British Columbia. And I said to him that I wanted to see whether this industry was humane for dogs or what was really going on. So we did film there. And then after a while, he said that he didn't want us to continue filming. The reason that I chose the place in Moonstone is because it was near Toronto. So it's about an hour and a half from Toronto. It was easy to access. And it was typical of a sled dog operation. So I went there asking if I could see a puppy being trained as a sled dog and to follow the impact it had on a puppy as they're training to become a sled dog. So that's why I ended up at Moonstone.
The new owners of the Colorado operation in
Kriblunik,
they said in your film that their dogs, and they say this as a point of pride, that their dogs are now allowed an average of 6 hours off tether per week. And yeah, this has seemed to be an improvement. So is this a common standard then throughout the industry? And why are sled dogs kept on tethers or chains for most of their lives?
Well, okay, if they're off tether for 6 hours a week, I'm not sure that's the correct number, but maybe it is, then that means it's 168 hours where these dogs are on chains. And 168 hours of these dogs on chains. And it is common throughout the industry. It is pervasive amongst the industry to keep these dogs on chains, or how they call it is tethering. And that is one of the greatest problems concerning the sled dog, concerning sled dog operations. We are getting to the point where we recognize that keeping any animal on a chain is cruel and inhumane. And in fact, there's anti-tethering legislation being enacted in throughout towns and cities in the United States, and certainly in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, and I know in a couple of years ago in Mississauga that they put up together anti-tethering legislation where you can't keep your dog chained all day because it's simply cruel. I can't think of any animal, any species that could survive and thrive living its life on a chain. And the truth is about sled dogs, at 6 months old, they are put on a chain for the rest of their lives. So they're left on a chain from, let's say, from 6 months old to, 10, 11, 12, to the duration of their life, all those years with their life at the end of a chain. And for dogs that are highly social animals that need to run and explore their environment and play with other dogs because they're highly social, to live their life on a chain exposes them to, it restricts their movements. It goes against their very needs as a dog, which is to play and to explore and to play with other dogs. They don't get that opportunity to play with other dogs and to be part of a pack. They're not part of a pack. Each of them are chained individually. So their very needs are taken away from them. And dogs do not eat, sleep, and eliminate in that very spot. They choose to do that in different areas. But because they live on a chain, they're forced to do that, which causes a great deal of anxiety. And when we rescued our dog, who lived on a chain for 9 years, he was at a point where animal veterinarians would call it learned helplessness. He had tried for so many years to escape that confinement, and then realized that he couldn't, and then had given up.
Shauna and I were just talking about the reasons why sled dogs would be kept on chains for their lives.
Basically for convenience. I mean, it you know, when you've got a kennel and you've got 50, 100, 200, 300 dogs, it's much more convenient and financially expedient not to keep them on chains. They're better organized that way. You can take them simply off the chain and put them back on a sled and then off the sled and on back on a chain. If you didn't keep them on chains, you'd have to have a lot more staff people to work with the dogs. If you put them all in one, you know, great big field together, fenced in field, you have the problem of fighting. So it's just easier. If you keep them on chains, it's easier for them. And remember, this is a business. I mean, this isn't an animal sanctuary, sled dog kennels. It's a business. And so the bottom line is making money, and the easiest way to work with the dogs is if they keep them on chains. So that's the reason that they do that. And again, you know, they say that these dogs are different from other dogs, that they're different from pet dogs, and therefore can be treated differently, which simply isn't true. They're dogs, and they have the same needs that any other dog would have. And so that is why they do this. They believe that, they say that they're different, and therefore they justify keeping these dogs on chains for the rest of their lives.
In fact, they are genetically the same as other domesticated dogs. They suffer
absolutely.
In the same ways.
Yeah. Absolutely. And absolutely, there is no difference. And I'm not saying that as a filmmaker. I'm not saying that as a journalist. I'm saying that because it's been proven in science. It's been proven in journals when they talk about the impact of chaining. And that's why there's been a push to stop chaining dogs. And there's been legislation in different communities, anti-chaining legislation. But to say that these dogs are different, it's a myth. And it's not the truth. It's just a myth. And they have exactly the same needs that any other dog mm-hmm. has. And, you know, in the case of my dog or other dogs that have been rescued, who are rescued sled dogs, it takes them a while to adjust to just being a dog again. Because all those things that dogs need to be able to run, to be part of a family, to play with other dogs, to chase, all that has been deprived from them so someone can make money, so someone can run a business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what the audience needs to understand. This is a business.
Yes.
It is a business. People are making money, and people are making money from these dogs. And whenever we have used animals as a way of making money, the animals suffer. And if we think about circuses, or we think about SeaWorld, or we think about, you know, any business that has used animals to make money, those animals are suffering. And that is why, thank goodness, people are beginning to say, enough, enough.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah.
I wanted to go back to something we referred to before. Up until the premiere of your film, the biggest wake-up call that the public is said to have received regarding the treatment of sled dogs is when the media reported the slaughter of 100 dogs in Whistler here in BC after the Winter Olympics in 2010. So can you tell us more about what happened there?
Well, what happened is they bred, you know, the Canadian public needs to know, and it's something I didn't know until I rescued my dog Slater, and until I started researching the whole issues of animal rights, animal welfare in Canada. I assumed, naively, I guess, as a progressive country, as a humane country, that our animal rights laws would be equally as humane, and I was shocked to find out that they were not. The dogs are considered property. They consider nothing more than property. And because they don't have any real legal right to real legal protection, that you can keep a dog chained its entire life, not just a sled dog, your own pet dog. You can keep your own pet dog chained its entire life as long as some kind of shelter and food is provided. And you have the right, as the owner of this piece of property, to shoot your dog as long as it's done humanely. And I put that in quotation marks, humanely, because I personally could never think of shooting a dog between its eyes and think of that as being humane. So the owner or the manager of this sled dog kennel in Whistler, B.C., had bred too many dogs for the Whistler Olympics. He knew that they would be getting a lot more tourists, so there were a lot more dogs to be bred. And at the end of it, when the tourist went home, he had an excess of all these dogs, and he was losing money. The bottom line is he was losing money. And so what he did is commonly done is call the herd. And so that's why he shot and killed 100 dogs. Now, what he did was legal. If he would have done it humanely, you need to understand, if he would have done it humanely, if they were clear shots between the dog's eyes, he never would have been charged. That because he had to do so many dogs and missed them and had to fire several times and many of the dogs suffered, that is the only reason that he was charged with animal cruelty. Calling the dogs is also the dirty, dark secret in these dog sled kennels. If they are losing money or they have too many dogs or the dogs are no longer useful, many of them do kill their dogs. You know, I'm not saying there aren't kennels that try to find them adoptive homes, but it is common to call the herd, and that's exactly what he did. The difference is because animals suffered, that's how the public found out, and that's why it came into a public's attention.
Yeah, so touching on that, alternatives, and there has been a fair bit of backlash from the industry since the trailer for your film came out. So what would you say to the mushers who claim that humanely run commercial dog sledding operations can and do exist?
Humanely run dog sled operations. Well, you know, I guess their definition of humane is very different from my definition of humane. The vast majority, and believe me, I've been a filmmaker for a very long time and did a lot of work for History Television, so I do a lot of research before I start any film. And it is pervasive in the industry to chain your dog. That is pervasive in the industry. And as I said, you know, the continual training of any species, you don't even have to look at the research. It's common sense that the continual training of any species is cruel and inhumane and against that species' natural way of living. So I think that in terms of what they say that they treat their dog humanely, I think we human beings are very good at putting forth our own narrative. This is their way of making a living. You know, it's traditional to chain a dog, even though we now know that in fact is anything but humane. And they have, you know, they're making a living. So they can look at the way they're treating their dogs and saying, well, this is humane. It's safer to keep a dog on a chain. They're different from pet dogs. I've had someone say to me, well, you know, yes, if a pet dog was kept on a chain all the time, that would be inhumane, but they're different. These are sled dogs, which is a label we humans have given these dogs. The only reason they're called sled dogs is because we humans gave them that label. They're just dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when you want to do something, when you want to run a race, or when you want to own a dog sled kennel and use that as your livelihood, you look at it through your own narrow perspective. And you don't want to see any evidence that goes against what you know and what you feel. I mean, I'm not painting the mushers in some kind of negative light. The person that I followed in the film who ran the Iditarod, Patrick Fields, is a wonderful person. He's a wonderful, wonderful person. But he wanted to believe what he wanted to believe because he wanted to race the Iditarod. So any evidence or any time I would say to him, look at Patrick, this goes against, you know, all the evidence supports that continual chaining of a species or running 1,000 miles is cruel and inhumane, and dogs are not meant to do that. Well, he didn't want to believe that, so he would argue the opposite. And you know, up until the time that I rescued Slater and had my eyes opened, I mean, I too did things that were against putting the welfare of animals. I too went dolphin swimming, and I too went elephant riding, not thinking of putting animals first or what that animal is living through. And I think, unfortunately, many of us do that because it's advertised as this, you know, exciting, positive thing. But the truth is that it isn't, and we want to believe our own narrative.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what do you think needs to happen next for sled dogs then? What can people do to help end the abuse of dogs in the commercial dog sledding industry?
Well, I would like to, what I'm hoping in this film to happen in this film. I mean, first of all, the film is giving information that I don't think the public ever had. I'm actually surprised as a filmmaker that this is the first film that went behind the scenes of sled dog operations and reported exactly what was going on. When I went dog sledding, I had no idea. I just took for granted that the dogs were loved and looked after. I had no other information that told me anything counter that. So now with this film, the information is out. And people need to decide for themselves if this is an industry they want to support, knowing the impact that this has on our four-legged very best friends.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, dogs are, we are a dog-loving nation. Canada is a dog-loving nation, and so we should be, because they're the one species that give us this unconditional love. I mean, I feel lucky that I recognize how incredible dogs are and have dogs and have animals in my life. And I think now that people, that what they see, what really goes on in dog sled operations, I hope that they will think about, you know, is this something they want to participate in, when really the reality is this harms dogs. This is against the welfare of these dogs. Well, and I'm hoping that, you know, what I hope would happen, what I would love to see happen, is to take these dogs off the chains and put them in homes where they belong. The only positive light in the end of that horrible thing that happened in Whistler is that the surviving dogs, 189 surviving dogs, they all got into homes. They're all in homes now. And it was the only bright light in my whole film was going to the reunion that Penny Stone, who is the director of Victoria Humane Society, every year she has a reunion for the sled dogs that she placed in homes. And to see these dogs with families now running freely, playing with children, playing with each other, it was the highlight of the film to see that,
mm-hmm,
to know how they used to live and to see them now. And I really hope what my dog went through doesn't continue to happen to thousands of our very best friends.
Well,
sorry, go ahead.
No worries. We're just running out of time here, but this is also great. And I just want to thank you so much for joining us on the show today to talk about your film and to share all this information with us about the realities of the dog sledding industry and uncovering the fallacies and misinformation that's been going around on this issue. So thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
To find out more about the commercial dog sledding industry and how you can view the film Sled Dogs, you can visit sleddogsfilm.com, and we'll have that posted on our Facebook page and our webpage for sure, Animal Voices
Vancouver. And it's going to be coming up on CBC Documentary Channel too.
Oh, right on. Perfect. Yep.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us next week for our show, next Friday, December 23rd, where we will be featuring Robin Raven, the author of the children's book, Santa's First Vegan Christmas. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts, read our show blog with detailed links, and subscribe via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show, either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. To end the show today, we are playing music from Sled Dogs. The soundtrack is by Steve D'Angelo. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.